Today's scripture reading is from Esther, chapter 4, verses 9 through 17, and chapter 9, verses 20 through 22. Hathach went and told Esther and Mordecai what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying, "All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman goes long to the king inside the inner court without being called, there's but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come to the king for 30 days. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you kept silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all of the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, enjoining them that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same month year by year as the days on which the Jews had gained relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of fasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and presents to the poor. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Well, I know what you're thinking. I don't remember him being quite that old. But here I am. This is what 14 years does to a person, right? 14 years ago today, this weekend, was my official last day on the payroll here at First United Methodist Church. And so 14 years have passed, and I've gotten older, and my hair grows in places it didn't used to grow, and all those kind of things are happening to me. How many were not here 14 years ago? Look at that. Isn't that great? That's a whole lot of people, and that means the church is continuing to renew itself and be refreshed, and I think that's really exciting. It's good news. Yeah. Well, today we're going to have a story, and as you can imagine, since we read from the book of Esther, it's the story of Esther. So let's just have that story and enjoy a summer Sunday, shall we? You know, it's hard to account for how it was that Ahasuerus became king. I mean, was it simply a roll of the dice or a casting of lots, or what was it that caused him to become the king? After all, if you look at his behavior, none of it looks like a guy who should have become king. I mean, it's not because he had this long-range vision of how the world was going to be and every decision he made from here to there was outlined so that it would lead to that decision. He couldn't see an inch in front of his face in terms of any kind of decisions. He ruled by emotion. Whatever he was mad about today was what he decided about today. Well, maybe he was interested in the welfare of his people. No, that's not right. I mean, with Ahasuerus, he had no policy in mind. He wasn't trying to make any kind of thing happen in his country. He really just had one policy, and that was party. Now, I don't mean Republican or Democrat party. I mean party. Party was what he did. And so it may be that the only reason he became king was because he was born into it. I mean, that just seems to be the only explanation we have. that he got there by way of his parents. But whatever it was, he had become king over Persia and ruled over 127 countries from India to Ethiopia. Or maybe that would be Ethiopia, I'm not sure. I don't know how big that is. My geography isn't good, but to me, that's big. 127 countries. Basically, he covered the entire known world at the time. And so that led to him having great wealth. And everything was going quite well for him. He could do anything he wanted. He was able to accomplish anything he wanted. And so on the third year of his reign, guess what policy he put in place? Let's have a party. So he gathered up all of his military leaders, all the people who had been in charge around the countries of protecting the people, brought them to the capital city of Susa. He got his governmental leaders together. Everybody who was anybody was there, and they had a party. And you might say, well, that's a little risky, isn't it? I mean, didn't that leave all the people in those 127 countries unprotected for a while? But, you know, if it's a party for a couple of days, you know, we all have our holidays. July 4th is our holiday where we all celebrate and kind of let things go for a day. Problem is, it wasn't for 1 or 2 days. His party lasted 180 days. There you go. Another partier. And it was not just the kind of party where you come in and you give everybody a glass of wine and everybody sips the wine and does that and goes home and does it again the next day. They didn't serve wine by the glass. They served wine by the jug. It was quite a party, right? Now, the good news is that the First United Methodist Church of Susa had heard about it, and so they got those jugs and they imprinted on their First United Methodist Church of Susa and come give us a chug. And it worked out really well. Well, I just added that little part in for Mary's sake. It wasn't there. But they were, it was a great party. But when they got to 180 days, you know what the king said? Well, that's not enough party. I got to have more party. So he scheduled another party that was going to last 7 days, not just for all the leaders, but for everybody in the capital city of Susa. So that not just anybody was there, but everybody who was nobody was there. It was a party for the whole community. Everybody came, and it was a great, lavish affair so that the king could show off his power, his wealth, his riches to all the people so they would know their place in comparison to him. Then about day 186, or somewhere in there, he looked around and said, "No, wait a minute. Somebody's missing. Where's Vashti, my wife?" Everybody was at the party except for the queen. And he thought to himself, "This isn't right. I need to show everybody how wonderful I have life by showing them how beautiful my wife is. And I want her to come out here and we'll parade her in front of all the rest of the people. And we'll put that tiara on her so that it will glisten from India to Ethiopia when she wears it. And all is going to be well so that everybody knows not only do I have all the property that I can have, I've got the most beautiful woman as well that goes across the entire country. I have it all." Now, that might have worked out okay if Ahasuerus had gone to Vashti, where she was, and said to her, "Vashti, you're a beautiful woman. I love you so much. We are partners in this work together, and I want you to come out so that everybody can see that you and I are working together, and you'll be able to demonstrate to them how wonderful a person you are." That might have worked, right? But instead, he gathered up his 7 servants and said to them, "You go tell Vashti to come out here and get on parade so that I can show her off." Now, how do you think that was going to work out? Apparently, Vashti wasn't so excited about that. And so when the servants came down and said to her, "You've got to come up here," she said, "I don't think I'll go." So the servants went back to the king and said, "She's not coming." And he said, "She's not coming." And he just got really angry. Now, he didn't know how to make a decision. He just knew how to get angry. So instead of making a decision himself, he gathered his 7 leaders together, all of whom happened to be men, and said to them, Vashti said she can't come up here. She's not coming up here. Can she do that?" Well, you know, they could have given him some good advice there, probably. They could have said, Well, King, maybe you just need to go to her and talk with her and have a conversation together and negotiate this kind of thing out. And in some kind of partnership, you can get this to happen so that she can have what she wants and you can have what you want. That might have worked out. But after all, these were men. And so they said to the king instead, they got defensive and began worrying for themselves. And they said, you can't let her do that. If Queen Vashti does not come and obey you, all the women around the country are going to come to their husbands and not do what they want. The men will lose their power and authority over the women all across this country. You've got to stop it. You see, the problem is that the king was being led by a group of men. And they had their own set of problems, didn't they? So what they said was, you've got to do this. You've got to tell her that she will be banished from the kingdom. You've got to lead her away so that she will not have a place in this kingdom ever again. She will be banished from the palace. She will never see you again. And the king thought, well, he was angry, right? And it seemed like a good idea to him. He said, well, that's great. Let's do it. And so they did. We need to understand here what's going on. Because you see, what's going on is that the men who were advising the king had looked at Vashti, and they had not seen Vashti. They had seen a group of people who have a pre-existing condition. What's a pre-existing condition? It's the kind of thing that when people look at you and don't see you but see the group you're in, you have a pre-existing condition. When people look at you and decide that you are who you are, you act the way you act because you are in that group, you have a pre-existing condition. Many cases we think that means that it's people who are an expense to our society. Today we've been talking about people with health conditions, right? That's been the popular topic about pre-existing conditions, and now they're too expensive for the insurance industry, and we've got to do something about that. But we do it all the time. Before that, it was people who are Muslim, or it's people who are illegal immigrants. Or before that, it's been people who were Hispanic or people who were African-American or people who were just not like me. But in this case, particular case, Vashti's pre-existing condition was that she was a woman. And the men knew they couldn't let the women have control or they would lose it all. You see, the problem is that the men had a pre-existing condition too, and that is that they were men. And so they decided to make an example of one person for the entire group. They had her banished. She was dismissed from the palace. And it all worked out really well for about a week. And then the king, who after all was a man, began thinking, wait a minute, where's my wife? I don't have a wife anymore. I'm all alone. What am I going to do? The men had created another crisis. And so these advisors got back together again, and they created another crisis out of the crisis, you might say. Their decision was, I know what we'll do. We will gather up all the available beautiful women in the country, and we'll prepare them and train them, and then we'll bring them back to the king one woman at a time every night. Every night he'll have a different woman until he finally gets to the place where he has the woman that he chooses, and then that can become the queen. And the king heard that plan, and, he had the pre-existing condition of being a man, right? And he said, wow, that's a pretty good idea. That sounds like heaven, he thought. And so that's what they did. Now, I should have this little aside in here for you, I think, and that is, as you're beginning to see, if anybody ever comes to you and says, the Bible says that men should be in charge of women and women should be quiet while the men do all the talking, you tell them, I don't think you've read the whole Bible yet. Maybe you need to read Esther, a book that was written 500 years before the time of Jesus, and was already scripture, basically, by the time Jesus was around, was already beginning to say, that isn't the way it's supposed to work. And for further reference, go back to Mark's sermon last week. Now, let's stop the story here, as if I already haven't, and go back and realize that there's a couple more characters to be introduced here. We have another set of people who were around who had this pre-existing another pre-existing condition. They were called Jews. They had come into this land, into the 127 countries, because of the exile. And they had settled there. And now, even though the exile was over and many Jews had returned to Jerusalem, some of them didn't. They just stayed where they were. And so here were the Jewish people who came into these various countries as immigrants and people who were not invited, people who had not expected to be there, who were taking up space and taking up jobs and doing all that kind of thing that the people thought they should have. And so they were not well respected. They were treated as if they were outsiders and the people who should be left to be silent. No one understood their culture, the way they worshiped, the gods that they worshiped, the God they worshiped, or any of that. And so scattered across these 127 countries were people who were Jewish and also considered to have a pre-existing condition. When you saw one, you saw the whole group and cast judgment. In Susa, there were a couple of people of note that were living there. One of them was named Mordecai. Mordecai had an uncle and the uncle's wife, his aunt, uncle and aunt, who had died when they were young, but they had a young daughter named Esther. And so Mordecai had adopted Esther and raised her as his own. Mordecai was a highly respectable kind of guy, and so Esther had learned that she could respect him and listen to him. And whenever he told her to do something, that's what she did. She always obeyed him. Well, you know, the name of the book that we're talking about today is Esther. So you might figure out here that Esther is going to be in this group of women that get picked to go before the king. And that's how it works out. She is picked. She's a very beautiful young woman. And so she is caused to go before the king. But before she goes, Mordecai says to her, Esther, don't tell anyone who you are, where you come from. You have to keep silence. You can't let anyone know. You just got to keep your head down so that nobody knows about your pre-existing condition. And so that's what Esther did. She didn't tell anybody. But as you know, she was selected. She became the queen. They had a great party. Everybody was happy. And Esther went to live in the palace where she was pampered and protected and lived a wonderful life where she had maids who surrounded her and did whatever she wanted them to do. It was a great life. So as she was living there, it turns out there were some people who decided to assassinate the king. Mordecai found out about the assassination attempt. He reported it to Esther. Esther reported it to the king. The king found out, determined that it was true, got rid of the people that were plotting the assassination, and wrote in his book of records that Mordecai had done something very honorable in protecting his life. So that's that part of the story. Now, at the same time, over here was a guy named Haman. And Haman was another one of those people who had risen through the ranks very quickly until he was second in command to King Ahasuerus. And you have to wonder how he got there. Roll of the dice? Was he born into it? Was it a casting of lots? When you read the story about Haman, you kind of get the idea that probably not. Probably it was because he knew how to bribe people. And he also was willing to tell lies rather than the truth. He would tell a little bit of the truth, but he would tell a whole lot of a lie. And a little bit of the truth made it look credible, but the lie was what got him where he wanted to go. And he was the kind of person who was willing to trick his way into position. And he got to where he was second in command. Now, that all sounds good. We've got Mordecai and Esther over here and Haman over here, and they don't know each other. They're not interacting with each other. Life is good, except that Haman loves the idea that as second in command, he can walk down the street. And when he walks down the street, everybody will bow down before him and cower in fear that he might do something to them. Everybody in Susa did that on behalf of Haman when he came down the street, except for one guy. And who do you think that was? Mordecai. Mordecai refused because he was living his Jewish life and he knew that he was not supposed to bow down to any human gods. He wouldn't do it. He didn't cower in fear. He didn't bow down to him. He just stood there and looked at him. And it infuriated Haman because he loved the power. Now, Haman found out who Mordecai was, learned that he was Jewish, and he did what other people were doing, right? He said, if he's a Jew, all Jews are bad. I've got to punish all the Jews because of Mordecai. Make an example of him. So he went to the king. And he told the king, I've got a plan. Well, no, that's not quite what he said. He said to the king, a little bit of truth, a little bit of a lie, some outright lie. He said, there are some people in your land here who are foreigners, and nobody understands their culture, the way they act or think, which was somewhat true. But then he said, and they're causing trouble, and they're going to destroy your country, and they're going to come and cause you to lose your power, which was not true. But the king didn't really care too much. He thought Haman might be telling the truth. He didn't want to know who the people were because, after all, he needed plausible deniability. And besides that, what was his policy in life? Party. He didn't really care too much about policy. He didn't want to know about those people. If they were bad, get rid of them. And then Haman said, and if you let me get rid of these people for you, I'll put 10,000 talents in your treasury, which today would be like saying, I'll give $1 billion into your account. And the king thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And so he said, sure, go do what you want to do. Do with them as you please. Take my ring, seal the proclamation you're going to make, and everything will be fine. And so Haman made a proclamation that on a certain day of a certain month, everyone who was Jewish would be held as accountable by everyone else who considered them an enemy. And anyone who considered a Jewish person an enemy in the 127 countries could take the life of the Jewish person, their family, and take their goods, take their property. It would be theirs. And nobody would be held accountable for that. In other words, all the Jewish people were to be annihilated. And then he rolled the dice to determine what day it would be. Now, I don't know how you read the dice. I don't know how that works, but he rolled the dice. That was how he made his decision. And it came out that a certain day, 11 months in the future, was the day that all the Jewish people were to die. Think about that for a second. That somebody tells you that 11 months from today is your day that you get to die. And tomorrow you're a day closer to it. And the day after that you're a day closer to it. It's got to be devastating. They sent that proclamation out and were told that the king and Mordecai, after they sent the proclamation out, sat down to eat and drink. But the city was thrown into confusion. Isn't that an incredible line? The people in power make their decision and they sit down to eat and die and drink, knowing it has nothing to do with them, while the country that they rule over is thrown into confusion. All the Jewish people were put into a time of mourning and fear and devastation. Mordecai began wearing sackcloth. And when he was wearing the sackcloth, Esther, who was living protected and pampered in the palace, saw that he was wearing sackcloth. She had no idea what was going on. She, after all, didn't care about any proclamations going on. She was living a nice, pampered life. But she didn't think Mordecai ought to be wearing sackcloth, so she sent down word, why is he wearing sackcloth? Or she sent down some new clothes for him, and he wouldn't wear them. And so then she sent a message back down and said, why aren't you wearing the new clothes I gave you? And so he sent the word back and said, gave her all the details as to how it was that all the Jewish people were going to die, and there was nothing they could do about it. And then he said, and Esther, you've got to do something about it. Implied in all of that was a change from what he told her before. You know I told you, Esther, that you're supposed to keep your head down, that you're not supposed to say anything. There's a time for being silent, but this is not the time. Now is the time to speak. Esther, as it turns out, was living a pretty good life, and she didn't have a need to do that. It's interesting, isn't it, how when we become wealthy, we quit caring about the things we cared about before. We'd quit wanting to take the risk of losing all of that. And so for the first time, when Mordecai told Esther what to do, she sent word back and said, I can't do that. If I go before the king, I'll die. If he doesn't invite me in, if his scepter doesn't rise as he sees me, I'll be dead. I can't go in there without an invitation. I can't go in uninvited. I can't speak when I don't have the floor. Now, she sent the message back to Mordecai, and I'm wondering what was going on in her mind at that moment. I kind of wonder that maybe she was already having God working on her. Maybe she was already beginning to pray, and maybe she was saying, God, this world is a mess. All the Jewish people are going to be annihilated. God, why don't you do something? And I'm wondering if maybe God said in that moment, I did. What? I created you. Mordecai sent back about the same message. He said, Esther, don't you think just because you are living pampered and protected in the palace that you're going to be spared from this devastation because you're Jewish yourself, you and your household, all your family will die with you. You need to understand, Esther, that there will be salvation that will come back to us and we will survive. But think about it. Maybe, just maybe, you've been put in this position of royalty for just such a time as this. I want to stop just long enough to let you ask the question yourself. Am I Esther today? Are you Esther today? The person who's been put in this position at this particular moment to bring salvation to the people who live with your pre-existing condition. We know how the story goes. Something happens inside of Esther, and suddenly we realize that she is being transformed even as that message comes back to her. And for the first time, instead of being a weak and silent person, Esther becomes a powerful leading person who is able to take a stand and is able to speak with a voice that is clear and distinct. And she gives the command back to Mordecai for the first time. Go and fast for 3 days. All the people who are Jewish fast for the next 3 days, and I'll be doing it with you. And in 3 days, I will go and I will speak to the king. And when I speak to the king, if I die, I will die. A woman of courage, bravery, a woman ready to speak, a woman ready to make a difference in the world. In spite of the pre-existing condition that she had been given, she was now ready to make a difference. And maybe it's true for you. Well, we've got to get the story done. So we're just going to go with this. It works out. Esther speaks to the king. He finds out that Haman has been responsible for this. Haman ends up hanging from a pole, and thus ends the story of Haman. Mordecai is lifted up to power and put in the position of Haman. And together, Mordecai and Esther are able to make another proclamation that the Jewish people will receive salvation and that they will be able to not live that day as a day of mourning, but as a day of celebration, the day that their lives were saved, so that from that day forward, that month forward, every year their festival of Purim is about the day that the dice were rolled to declare their death, but in turn, instead, it turned out to be their day of salvation, celebrated every year. But we need to hear the last of this, too. And that is, it's often true that when we get over being the person who is the victim and become the person who is an authority, we also often begin to victimize the people below us. But Mordecai and Esther didn't do that. They somehow had stayed attuned to God by making their decisions based on following after God and their prayer and fasting. So that when they made that proclamation and the people began to celebrate, two commands were given to the people as to how they would celebrate. First, that they would give gifts to each other. And if you heard the last phrase of the last sentence that Gwen read, what they were told was to make offerings to the poor, the outcast, the voiceless, the silent ones, the ones that were the pre-existing condition to beat all pre-existing conditions, the poor that we always have with us, were not to be cast aside, but were to be honored in this celebration. And so, what we learn here is that when God looks at us, God could look at us and say, look at those people with that pre-existing condition I call sin. But instead of looking at us that way, God looks at us and says, that's not a person I look at and say, there's a sinner. I look at that person and say, well, no, that's Jan, my child, the one I love. And today, we know we have this pre-existing condition that calls us together, and it's called the pre-existing condition of grace. Loved, forgiven, and now challenged. Not to be pampered, protected in the palace, but to be the one who stands as Esther stood and say, I will speak even if uninvited. I will speak even if I don't have the floor. I will speak of God's love and mercy. Now go and speak.